listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Good evening. Welcome to the Aloud series at Central Library. Tonight's program, Shooting Reflections on Film and Social Change. Our lens focuses on the creative mind behind the camera and in front of it. Filmmaker Diego Luna commented, "Acting became the chance to find a point of view. I believe the screen is a mirror and has to work as a mirror. Otherwise, it has no point of existing. This quest to uncover and reveal the mysteries of identity, purpose, and community define the career of the already prolific and versatile actor, director, and producer, Diego Luna. His acting roles include the award-winning biopics such as Before Night Falls, Frida and Milk, to the whimsical and fraternal Y Tu Mamá También, Rudo y Cursi, and Casa de Mi Padre, all of which Luna stars alongside his long-term friend, Gael Garcia Bernal. Together, the two have formed their own production company called Canana Films, a force in Mexico and Latin American film production, spotlighting work that brings social justice issues to the forefront. And they are also involved in producing a film you may have just heard about called No, that's nominated for an Oscar, foreign language film, about Chile's history. I just saw it last week and highly recommend it. So congrats to Canana and Diego and his whole team for getting that out there. In the political realm, Luna has joined forces with others in the media world to speak out against the widespread violence and impunity pervasive in his home country under the campaign El Grito Más Fuerte. He supports the work of Javier Cecilia, who also visited Aloud last year, and the binational movement for peace with justice and dignity. And tonight we're privileged to hear a sneak peek about his forthcoming feature, Chavez, based on the life and work of civil rights activist Cesar Chavez. Somewhere between a nonstop international travel schedule, post-production on a film, and being a family man and father to two children, Diego Luna has generously found a moment of time to spend with us at the library, and we're truly honored. Leading him in conversation tonight is another great storyteller, the talented and award-winning journalist and NPR correspondent Mandalit Del Barco, whose work has spanned urban street culture, police and prisons, gun violence, marijuana, immigration, and race relations. The stories she follows have taken Del Barco to her native Peru, Argentina, El Salvador, and Honduras, for stories ranging from street gangs to a profile on tango legend Carlos Gardel. Every year, she covers the Oscars and the Grammy Awards for NPR. Her features can be heard on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Weekend Edition. Del Barco is also a mentor for young journalists. Órale pues, it's time to welcome them to the Aloud stage at the Los Angeles Public Library. Demos una gran bienvenida a Diego Luna y Mandalit Del Barco.
Hey.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you to the Library Foundation for having this great event. And wow, it's a packed house, right? I think there were even people waiting to get in, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you, Diego, for
thank you.
For,
what a great introduction. Wow. Amazing. Just what I wanted to remember.
Yeah.
She skipped everything I hate.
Yeah.
I love it. I love
maybe
it.
They'll have a chance to ask you about that in the Q&A section. Si se puede.
Exacto.
Yeah? Your latest film, your new film that you're directing, is a film feature, the first feature film about Cesar Chavez, who I know probably everybody in this audience knows who Cesar Chavez is. And I even had a chance to meet him once, and that was amazing. And it's about his fight for farm workers' rights. And I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about it. It's in English, right?
Yeah, well, it's in Spanglish. Yeah. The whole idea is to do it as authentic as possible, and I'll tell you why. I mean, me and my wife, we came to this country to have a baby, trying to scrape from the craziness of Mexico City, and on a way, you know, I was a victim of many prejudices, and you know, there's a lot of prejudice about Mexican-American community in Mexico and about Mexican-American community in this country.
Right.
So I was part of that, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked that my kid was going to be Mexican-American. And I said, damn, this is weird. He's going to get an American passport before a Mexican. And I started researching and trying to find out, because I believe there's an amazing story behind that, what it is to be a Mexican-American. You know, what it is to be born here, to come, to have your past across the border, to have a wall that they're trying to build for you to not be in touch at all with where you come from. And this feeling also to, like, the necessity of belonging into this country, but also the necessity of not losing that connects you with Latin America. And I thought it was very strange that there was no film about Cesar Chavez. And I believe I knew why, but I still don't know if I'm sure. Definitely, it's a reality what happens in the fields that this country doesn't want to admit. You know, it's that part of the double moral thing where we do love to have food in our table, but we don't want to know where it comes from. You know, mm-hmm. Because we might be responsible. And part of the whole system that creates this amount of impunity, of injustice, and yeah, that lack of the basic stuff, you know. And this guy was fighting for that, and I thought it was an amazing way to start working in this country, and it was the right film for me to do, and to show to my kid when he tells me why, you know, why I was born in the States and you weren't. Alfonso Cuarón calls us braceros de lujo, but because yeah, we don't have to go through the punishment of all these people trying to survive and looking for a better way to raise their kids. But definitely, you come to this country and they ask you to change your accent or your name. And reading about Cesar Chavez, it was amazing to find out that Spanish, like, this is a great, to talk about the complexity of the film. He talked to his kids in English, to his parents in Spanish, and to his wife in English. And he had to practice Spanish to talk to the workers, you know, in order to defend them. And that tells you a lot of that complexity, you
right.
know. If you have to go through that just to melt and to belong, it's quite sad, you know, that you're forced to stop being who you are. And I just love the idea of telling the story of a hero that is just one of us, you know. He doesn't fly. He doesn't have to be represented by the ex-governor or someone like that. It's just with words, with ideas, and with work, mm-hmm. hard work, you know. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, it's an amazing chance to talk to the audience and empower the people in this country and tell them it's easy. If there's something you don't like, you can do something about it, because probably there's someone out there that thinks the same way, you know.
And it's interesting that you're Mexican coming to this country to tell a story about a Mexican American, and if there hadn't been any, you know, Mexican Americans or Americans who had told that story before,
it still makes no sense. I have to say, but yeah, and it was quite special. You know, we were in Mexico. We shot the whole film in Mexico because, obviously, for the budget, it was easier to shoot there. And it all happens in the 60s, so we had to build everything because California doesn't look like the 60s anymore. You know, the, if you go to the fields, I mean, they're all new and the future is there and machines.
Automated,
it's just the conditions that are kind of the same,
right,
you know, for the workers. But everything else has changed amazingly. And we went to Sonora, and this was, this is, we were as authentic as you can be, because we were scouting in Sonora, where it's the state of Sonora is the state that produces 80% of the table grapes in Mexico, so the fields are huge, and we were there, and I loved one place, and I say, who owns this place? We have to talk to them and ask them to let us live here and spend two months of our lives shooting the film. And they said, Guimara. And I was like, Guimara? Really? But you have to see the film. But the Guimara family was one of the biggest families he had to fight.
And were the conditions like they were in 1960s?
No. I have to say, very different. Uh-huh. You know, things are changing. You know, there's workers from this country crossing to Mexico.
Yes.
To work when the time of picking is happening there.
They go
and
back
they
and
come
forth.
Back.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It has changed. But but it was amazing to find out that after what Cesar Chavez did, they went to buy the world, you know, in a way.
Wow.
And they said, okay, let's go to Mexico where we can do anything we want. And they said, yeah, you're welcome.
There they are.
So I can say that at least the grapes are the grapes they were fighting for, you know.
And the film focuses on the grape boycott, the fight for the...
Yeah, I don't know, I was very scared of doing a film about the life of someone.
Yeah.
Because then it's very unfair, and you can't tell the life of someone in 2 hours, you know. It's like the speech, you just tell the amazing stuff and that's it, you know. But then what about everything else? And by doing research, I realized that what I care the most about was the boycott they did, you know, the great boycott they did in from the middle, from 68 to 71, you know, 74. Because it's an amazing idea, you know, that you can boycott a whole industry, the most powerful industry of California, you know, at the time. And the story went out of the state, went to the whole country,
right,
then to the world. The guy was Man of the Year for the Time magazine, was huge. He was, you know, there's pictures with him and the Pope that he was received in London, in Sweden, in everywhere. His story went everywhere. And today, I promise you, you ask 80% of the people walking in the Cesar Chavez Boulevard who was Cesar Chavez, and they'll tell you he's a boxer. So.
Yeah. He called himself Caesar, didn't he?
Caesar, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's an American.
Right.
He was born in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he called himself Caesar. And if you read his biography, there's horrible stories in school of what would happen if you spoke Spanish then. So yeah, he called his... I mean, in fact, he had 8 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the first ones have Mexican names and the others have American names, you know. It's an amazing and very complex journey, the one of those who belong to that community.
You know, we have a few still photos from the production that we wanted to share with you. You're going to sneak peek at this film that
we're not ready, so we couldn't show you a trailer or anything.
But here's Diego. Here you are.
Oh, exactly. that's how you look after being 3 weeks on the field, so. But what was amazing was that many of the people working in the film, many of the extras were actual workers and people that had some kind of connection with the story we were telling. So yeah, this is Sonora. The recreation of the movement was easy because it's a movement that is they're well documented.
Yeah.
There's documentaries to see, pictures to look at. In the foundation, they have a museum in Salinas with amazing stuff. So let me change. And that's our actor.
Michael Peña. You recognize him?
Michael Peña is not just an amazing actor, but his story is so close to Cesar's. The way he talks about his father, he's a first generation coming from Chicago.
Right.
But he understood and perfectly I have to say that playing Cesar Chavez was the most difficult thing that can happen to an actor, you know? Because when you play a character like this, you want to be big, you want to be Martin Luther King and have a speech that, you know, gets everyone to cry and you have them here and be very... And Cesar was a very modest guy, very, very humble. Quite complex.
Powerful as well.
Imagine the guy turned vegetarian, you know? I mean, probably you're not as shocked as I was, but the guy was coming from a Mexican family where carnes asadas were big, chorizo, everything. And the guy, when he was fasting once, he said, "I'm gonna turn vegetarian." Wow. Because of his love for animals, but he kept doing carne asadas for everyone, you know.
Everyone else.
he was very committed guy, but. Also, he's a Catholic that did yoga, loved meditating. It's quite
very
an interesting personality, and he tells you about
this
community.
He's a Californian.
Community.
What are you gonna, I mean?
I guess he is. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
So we have.
Okay, more. This is him again.
The other actors who are in this.
Rosario Dawson plays Dolores Huerta.
Dolores, who's lives.
Yeah.
She's always around.
Yeah.
Maybe one of her kids is here. I don't know.
Well, she also had a big task on this film. I'm talking about Rosario because Dolores is such an interesting character.
Was she on the set too? Did you talk to someone?
No, you can't do that.
No.
Otherwise, that day the film would be about Dolores and not Cesar, you know?
It's I see.
You have to... I worked closely with the family. We interviewed everyone. We read everything. But
right.
Once you're shooting, you have to forget about that. And that's why a fiction film can't be compared to a documentary because it's my point of view and it's what I care from everything I researched and I got from everyone. But no, not on set. No. There was one story where an actor was about to start a scene, and I saw him on the phone. He was playing Gilbert Padilla. His name is Yancy Arias. And he was on the phone, and he hung, and he turned to me and said, "You know what? Gilbert said he would never say this."
Oh.
with the cameras and everything. That day,
we
prohibited cell phones on set. And this is just a cool picture I like. But
America Ferrera is also in.
America Ferrera plays Helen Chavez and did an amazing job also. Jacob Vargas plays Richard Chavez. John Malkovich gets to play the grower. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see this film.
Me neither. Yeah. Yeah. It's
when is it going to be
When is it going to be out?
You're still working on it.
I hope end of summer, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, towards then. We're about to lock the editing, but then we have a lot of visual effects to work on and the music, and it's...
Wow.
Directing is... It's a tough work.
So
you know,
tell
us 4 years of your life.
And tell us what have you learned from being an actor for so long that helps you as a director? I mean, it must be you're in control then as a director of everything.
It's a very different experience.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did it because otherwise I would have become a horrible actor to work with. You know, because many times actors are trying to direct when they're acting, and it's a complete different story, you know. As an actor, you're a tool of someone else's point of view, and it's about understanding, listening, and then interpreting what someone else would love to say, you know. And you have to live in that place designed by someone else, and sometimes that's amazing, and sometimes that's painful. I think also I learned a lot of the terrible directors I've worked with, you know. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So I'm not going to say it.
No but, names. No, but it must be hard then to go back to being an actor once you've gotten a little taste of directing, though.
No, I think it's fresh air because directing is so intense, so profound, and that's why it's so amazing, and I want to do it, I believe, for many years, because it's so personal, and it's a process of it's better than any shrink, better than any therapy, because you confront yourself with your ideas, you know, and you're the only one from beginning to end there, you know. There's so many celebrations. You celebrate the end of writing the script, and then the writer gets drunk, hungover, and he moves to something else, and the next morning you have to start rehearsing and casting, and then you celebrate the wrap, but then you have to go editing, then, you know, so...
It never ends.
And
then you go to the Oscars and get your award. Then it still doesn't end.
I'm not going to complain if that happens, but I learned a lot as an actor, and I believe I learned more in theater than anywhere else, you know, because I believe theater is for actors like cinema is for directors, you know. In theater, the actors is on stage. Someone gives you all the information they can, but once you're on stage, it's an experience that happens between the actor and the audience, and there's a text and light, and it's as simple as that. You know, if one day you come in and you're depressed, that depression comes out in the show. If the show changes with you, and in cinema it's kind of the same for the director, you know. No matter how green you think the story is, if I saw it red, it's going to be red, you know. And the director finishes the writing on the editing, you know. When you decide to put this here and this here, it makes one sense. If you change it, it's completely different. Right. So it's a process that also asks you for 3 years to know why you're doing something, you know. Right now, if I wouldn't know exactly why I'm doing this, probably I would be suffering, you know. Because imagine how much you change my, you know.
Yeah, 3 years.
I have a daughter now. I didn't have a daughter when I started this film. It's intense.
Life changing.
It's intense. So I believe there's nothing like directing and cinema to express, and that's why I do it.
But you started out as in the theater. Your parents were in the theater.
Yeah.
Right?
I love theater. See, it's an amazing journey. It's like an orphan's dream, you know. You have a family. They all want to do the same. They all care about the same. It's so exciting. It's new and refreshing, and every night is a new experience. It's amazing. But also I got tired of doing it.
Well, you were doing this since you were
six. Yep.
Six mm-hmm. years old. If you don't know already, Diego started in telenovelas in Mexico.
Here we go. Everything was going perfect. Downtown didn't know anything about this. It's ridiculous.
Well, you didn't just pop on the scene, right? You've been an actor for many years. But and actually, going back to before I finish talking about Cesar Chavez. I understand that that you had to really get the Chicano dialect from the 60s and 70s down. Can you give us a little sample of
that? Oh, you mean, no, but I wasn't
acting. Well, you had to direct them, right?
Yeah. But I got a dialect coach because I cannot listen to it. You know, if you listen to my English, you'll understand I do not control the language perfectly.
Oh, I think you sound great.
But no, the actors, I wanted the film to sound as authentic as possible. And definitely the way the community speaks today has no connection with how they spoke, you know. Mm-hmm. And with Cesar, there was many videos for Michael to look at and listen to. But yeah, that was part of the whole thing, you know.
That's great.
Yeah.
To have the Mexican, were the Mexican extras having to speak in Chicano?
A few of them, and a few didn't, because that's why Cesar had to practice a lot his Spanish, because the way to engage with the farm workers was mostly in Spanish. So when he talks to the farm workers, or when he's like in a room like this and trying to explain to the farm workers the next step, he does it in Spanish, And then he talks to his gang in English. So
I heard that's what you had to do on the set.
Well,
action,
yeah.
And acción.
No, kind of, yeah. But also my directing, you know, because directing is also about what's in between good and fantastic, you know. It's all about subtleties, and my English is, I'm like, white, black, that's it, you know. So I needed someone
like
there to
Spanish
help
actually.
Me.
You know, in the movies, though, you've played a lot of historical figures. You've played everyone from Frida Kahlo's first boyfriend to Harvey Milk's lover, Jack Lita. And how many of you saw the film Milk? It was great, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was
I've
great.
I've kissed great people, yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, we have a scene.
You don't know. I didn't say it was fantastic.
Oh.
That was you.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're not going to kiss and tell. but I wanted to play a little clip of from Milk for in case you, just to remind you of the amazing performance that
Diego had.
So how do you choose your roles? Or for example, this one, how did you decide how to play that character as well?
On this one, Gus Van Sant, just the chance to work with such a fantastic director, and then everything around obviously made sense, you know, and amazing actors, a fantastic DP, and the whole, but also the chance to do a film like this that had a meaning and there was a necessity of a film like this to be made, I believe. I love when film find a necessity out there, you know. When we were premiering this, there was they were voting on proposition something.
Eight.
That was eight.
Yes.
That it was gay marriage. And
mm-hmm.
I remember there was demonstrations here in Hollywood.
Yes.
And, while we were having the premiere at the AFI, you know, and I don't know. It's I get excited when there's a chance to say something about the world we're living, you know, instead of just pure entertainment. And then the role was amazing because it's a guy that no one knows, quite a sad story. But also that I realized that no one really liked him around him, you know.
Around Harvey Milk.
And to me, it was... there was something that didn't connect, because if Harvey gave him so much time, so much love, there was obviously something about this kid that people is forgetting about, and to have the chance to represent that was a nice challenge.
That was really nice work. Well, and as you say, the films that you've done have been about something else, but you've also spoken out in your own, as an actor, as having a platform, about different issues that you found. I mean, I recently read that you told President Obama to keep guns out of Mexico, for example.
I sent him a letter. You put it as if we were, you know, having breakfast, and I said, "Oh, can I get the milk?" And by the way,
that was the headline. Okay. What did you want to say in that letter?
Well, the thing is, it's one step to talk about a bigger thing, but there's a war happening in Mexico, and I believe not many knew this in this country, and it looked like there's just violence happening, but there is a war happening, and it's because there's a market, and it's a shared responsibility these two countries have, you know, and I don't believe they work together. I met Javier Sicilia, that I heard it was here, and I, after listening to his story and the story of all the others in the movement, all the victims, I realized I had to do something, because I didn't wanted to be sitting on those tables, you know, discussing with them. I didn't want to wait till something happened to me too close to react. And And I started working with WOLA, which is the Washington office on Latin America, and they do an amazing work. And nobody talks about it, but there is the gun trafficking is amazing, and it's happening, and it's ridiculous, you know, because there's one thing to discuss is the amendment, and I'm happy to not even get close to that because I'm Mexican, but the other thing is if anyone can go to a gun show and buy a gun, and if after 80,000 people have been killed in Mexico, and there's numbers that say that from 70% to 80% of the weapons found on the area where the violence happened came from the States, then there's something really clear that has to be done. You know, mm-hmm. there's some that needs to be closed in order for one day to dream about a country that doesn't live in under that violence. You know, and the whole idea was just to regulate who buys them and what happens with those guns. You know, and so we were talking about that because it's unbelievable. There's some gun shows that I mean, you need a. My wife needs a driving license to get a beer, but not a gun, you know.
Yeah, I was talking to some kids in South L.A., and they told me it just a phone call away to get a gun.
Yeah.
No background check, no nothing. I mean, in certain areas, you know, that's how people
get
guns.
Yeah, there's gun stores that mm-hmm. run differently, but the gun shows, and 80% of the gun shows happen on the border. Mm. So it's like, well, there's a no-brainer there. I mean, this is an amazing business that someone's doing, and there's a very catastrophic thing happening and consequence because of that. So,
have you heard back from anybody in Washington yet?
No. Yeah, I was gonna make a joke, but not. I shouldn't because definitely. That's the weird thing I don't understand about. Politics, you know, when people want to do something but they can't, you know, the same with the migration policies, you know, it's like, really, do we have to wait another 4 years? Ah, okay, it's clear that many want to do something, you know, but the structure does not allow things to happen, and it's a huge business, and someone's gonna stop making money definitely, but it needs to happen, you know, because. The reality in Mexico is that the war is happening everywhere now, you know, and it hasn't stopped. So it's been many years, many people, and I don't know how many more we need to have, you know.
Well, do you ever get any feedback because of you're such a public person when you do have this platform to talk about different issues? Does you ever get any negative reaction from Hollywood, from in the film industry when you speak out?
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now with these amazing tools like Twitter and stuff like that, you do get all of that.
But I mean, in terms of you working or getting roles or getting anything from Hollywood. It seems like there a lot of people speak out in Hollywood, actually. But
Yeah, I have. I mean, definitely. But I have to say, I found many more cheers and people wanting to do something than negative reactions. You know, it's not something you have to be on the right, on the left, on the center to agree on. You know, no one wants violence like this to happen, mm-hmm. and no one would like to be one of those families. You know, so it's. It's a no-brainer, I believe.
Well, I wanted to switch to a slightly different subject, and that is the friendship and the working relationship you have with your friend Gael Garcia Bernal. I had a chance to interview him last week about his new film, your new film, No, about the plebiscite in Chile, and that's coming out. That's have you heard of this film yet? It's
very good. You know? It's coming out on the 22nd, I believe.
And it's up for an Oscar.
Or 15th.
It's up for an Oscar in the foreign language category, so that's a really amazing. So you've been working on that as well, right? Your company has been. But I'm interested in this working and friendship relationship you have with Gael Garcia Bernal.
Why do you want to know about Gael that he didn't say? Tell me.
Well, first I want to...
You're going through projects that I didn't have to do anything with. What do you want to know?
Oh, boy.
How tall he is?
I know he's... Yeah.
Oh, you met him.
Yeah, I met him.
What
beautiful
else
eyes.
Do you want to know?
Yeah.
What
secrets do you... But you've known each other your whole lives.
Yeah. I was born a year later, so he knows me for my whole life.
Well, I wanted to just, again, indulge the audience in seeing a scene from the film that was one of the big breakthroughs that you both had, Y Tu Mamá También. You all know this movie, right? It's a very fun movie. So maybe we can watch a little scene from this film, too. So what was the manifesto again? Hard drinking and...
I don't remember the whole...
Yeah, it was partying, I think, mostly.
There's one thing that says... No, I don't remember. I'm going to skip it.
Wait, in this film, were you guys able to improvise in any scenes, or was it very...
No, yeah. But it was more on rehearsals that we improvised. You know, the script was fantastically written by a 40-year-old. So when 40-year-olds want to talk like kids, it sounds terribly ridiculous. So we had to kind of translate it to a younger voice. So, but yeah, we improvised a lot, but it was always with the presence of the writer there, who's Alfonso. Alfonso is the director, the writer is Carlos Cuarón, and so he was always there with us. And yeah, but on set it didn't happen that much. Eh?
Do all of you know the storyline of this film? It's just two sexually adventurous friends, a coming-of-age story, all of the above.
Two 17-year-old kids.
Exactly.
You say everything just by saying that. Yeah.
So is that kind of like your relationship, you and Gael's just...
Hey, now I know what you wanted to know. Ever been a trip like that between you and Gael? And who's the third? No. It's based on Alfonso's stories.
Okay. But so I guess what I mean is like this, I mean, you guys are really comfortable with each other.
I have to say that we started working when we were very young, and we believed we were adults when we were 10, you know, and we had a very different and weird kind of life when we were young, and I think we thought when we shot this film we thought we were making a point on young generations, and that we were being sarcastic about them, but I believe that half the way we realized we were those kids, you know. And Alfonso was too, you know. I remember moments when we would be rehearsing, and the first one would be Alfonso to do this when a cute girl was just walking, you know, and then us, and it was like the Charolastras kind of came to us, and we became them, and the whole spirit around this film, it's what I believe makes the film so strong, you know, that we were all on that journey. A few of us, it was the first time. Others were repeating it for the third or fourth. Mm-hmm. But definitely, it talks also about being young in Mexico, where you can do things like that, you know, get a car. I mean, if you belong to that part of the society, they can do anything they want because impunity is huge. Yeah. Well, yeah, you definitely can grab a car, drink, go to the beach, and do a crazy trip like this, you know, with no apparent consequences, you know, until you realize you have that on your DNA, you know, and you're... You know, braving the nurse in the hospital to be able to watch your kid a little longer, and you're like, oh my god, what am I doing? You know, but it's us. So it's a very honest portrait of a world we knew very well.
Yeah. Well, what I liked also, besides that story, is just to be able to see different scenes in Mexico. Mm-hmm. When the camera goes into the kitchen and you see the people just working there, or the whatever, you know, all the different levels of society. I thought that was
We got really a lot of hate mails saying, why do you show that Mexico? Why do you show Mexico dirty and poor? You shouldn't do that. If you go to the beach, you go to Acapulco or Cancun, and it looks amazing.
Wow.
And the whole spirit of the film was exactly to be honest about who we are, you know? The good, the bad, everything, because we are that, you know? It's an awakening film in many ways, you know? And it came exactly when the country was waking up also, you know? It was when the first election that actually we believed people vote for someone that went to then became the president. It happened when we were promoting this film, and I believe, it's a film about these teenagers, but also a teenage country that it was finding his personality and so.
Well, your films are always at the right moment, huh?
Not all of them. Again, you're just mentioning the ones that work.
Casa de mi padre.
Casa de mi padre. Yeah, I was.
That was a fun.
That was a crazy film, yeah.
You know, this film is a spoof of the telenovelas. And always, you know, the exaggerated.
Yeah. And
movements and
it's a satire. And for us, acting there was amazing because everything we were never allowed to do, we were asked to do now.
Yeah.
You know, it was a film about how many mistakes you can do, how much of bad acting you can do, and it was a fantastic experience.
That must have been fun after having been in all those telenovelas, right?
Okay. I did a few.
Hey, it's fun. You were just a kid then.
I was a kid. My father needed the money. Okay, let's change the subject.
Well, I wanted to... going back to Gael, you have a film company together.
Yeah.
Canana Films. And I know you've done quite a number... you've produced several films already. And is that who's doing the Chavez?
It's Canana.
Yeah. So some of the films that he's produced, I don't know if you've seen it, seen Nombre, about the... Mara Salvatrucha, gang member who crosses the border by train, right? Mm-hmm. And Miss Bala, about a beauty pageant queen who gets involved with the narco traffickers. But also, I know you've done some documentaries about the Ciudad Juarez, the killings there of the women who were in Ciudad Juarez. And your production company also has this incredible project called Ambulante. Right, it's showing documentaries around different parts of Mexico.
Exactly,
like a festival.
The idea started because a friend of ours did an amazing documentary, and we were promoting some film, and we said we should help him. You know, Gael said, "Watch it, it's amazing." I watched it, and I said, "Yes, let's do it." And we remembered one night the most amazing screening of Y Tu Mamá También was at the MoMA. In New York, and it was hosted by Julian Schnabel and Lou Reed, and they would invite you to see a film that, if their names weren't there, nobody would go watch, and it was amazing. You don't know who was there. It was like their friends. It was unbelievable. You know, the film was happening here, and we were like this. You know, looking at the faces of everyone, saying this is an amazing idea. So we said, let's do something like it for the film of our friend, and then. When we realized the amount of work that we needed to do, we said, let's do it for 10 films because it's going to take a month of our lives. And then we said, let's do a film festival. But we didn't want it to do a film festival like the ones we go to that are just for a niche, you know, that just a few people can watch. And it's like getting into a bubble where everything is about cinema, but then you go out to the real world and there's no connection. So we said, let's organize more of a rock tour kind of thing, you know?
For documentaries.
Wow. So the idea is it's a selection. Today we've been doing it for 7 years, and today is 80-something titles that travel to your city and stay in one city for a whole week, you know? And that week you can go to the cinemas, but also to the plazas, to the galleries. We even had a program for jails, you know, where they would just allow us to show one or two because all of the others, they didn't want it. But at least there was some documentaries happening there too, showing their story. And the whole thing was amazing. It's the healthiest project we've ever done. We started, again, as I said, 7 years ago. And it has grown amazingly. Today, there's more than 100,000 people watching this. And it travels around Mexico. And it's a very interesting thing because for many years, people and distributors would say, you know, no one wants to watch documentaries. There was no way to get them out, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not like other cities, you know, Mexico City. Mexico City has one or two places where they specialize in documentaries. But the whole country is... It was empty, you know, and it was virgin. And we decided to move this around, and now there's like another five festivals. There are cinemas that are showing them for the whole year. It's quite an amazing event.
Well, we have a little promo tape to show you just to get a flavor of what one of these festivals is like.
We can go to the clip later. But I have to say that with documentaries, there's something magic that happens, you know. It has an instant impact on the audience, you know. No matter how far away that story is from, you know, if you are or not connected. Because it's like a glimpse on the reality of someone that you always have the chance to reflect on how does that affect you, where you are. In terms of whatever issue you're seeing, you know, and because cinema also should be seen like in a proper
communal place,
you know, where you sit down and you're asked to turn your cell phone off and spend an hour and a half looking at a screen, you know. And if you do it that way, there's no way to run away, you know. There's always a reaction, and documentaries start debates, you know, reflections. It's a tool of change in many ways.
What are some of the themes of the documentaries that you've had?
Well, today we have many sections. We have one that is called Dictator's Cut that is all about censorship, either things that have been censored or that reflect on censorship. We have one called Sonidero that is about music, you know, in the world, and it's quite engaging because many bands come and present their documentaries. Mm-hmm. Every year it changes, you know, and we have an amazing team working behind this. It's like it has grown, and it's a different office now, and it has been taken by the audience and by those who make it. You know,
why don't you bring it to LA?
There's a selection at the LA Film Festival.
Oh, the Film Festival. Yes.
They normally at least that happened 3 years ago, I think. They presented like the 7 Mexican documentaries we had, and we did a little selection for them. And it's been traveling around, and it's
too bad we couldn't play the clip. It's just the clip shows just a huge tent or a hanger
Something that we started doing last year, which is there's a festival, a music festival called Vive Latino in Mexico. It's attended by thousands, and we have a tent there now where we just present stuff that is about music, and in the best cases is presented by musicians, and it's an amazing chance for those who are part of the crowds looking at your star over there jumping and singing. Then suddenly they come into a place like this and they have a chance to chat and to see who they are and what they care about. Many times we don't show documentaries about bands, but documentaries that they want to show to people, you know.
There must be a lot of documentary makers in Mexico then.
There is. Wow. It's healthier than the fiction industry. Yeah, definitely. Wow. And also because I believe the documentaries have filled a gap that has been left there from movies, because it's so difficult to finance a film these years, you know, this time. So no one wants to get out of what has worked, you know, and there's like so specific rules that kind of underestimate the necessity of the audience to be surprised, impressed, confronted, you know. So documentaries have sneak in, and there's many filmmakers today that are doing fake documentaries, you know, in order to have that chance to talk to people in a more horizontal way, you know.
Well, we're very happy to be speaking to you horizontally. And I know we don't have that much time, but I do want to give the audience some time to ask some questions too. Oh boy.
No, maybe.
So we have people with microphones.
Hi. Oh. I'm your wife. I want you to tell them about the ambulante on the border.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me. I thought you also wanted to know about Gael. I was like, okay, I'll tell you. I'll tell you if it happened. So that's my wife, yeah. I didn't bring my kids because it's too late, and they were gonna show a clip of Y Tu Mama También, but we did a program, an amazing program in last year in Tijuana and San Diego, you know, and it was called Ambulante Borders, and the idea was we showed in both places the same documentaries. We had round tables of experts in every issue. We talked about gun trafficking. We talked about the experience of migration all the way from Central America to the States. And the third issue was, I don't remember the third one. But the idea was to confront points of view with the two countries. And we realized there's so much in common in the points of view that it's weird we don't raise our voice together, you know. There was a teacher from a university in Miami saying amazing stuff that sounded like I was listening to Javier Sicilia, and he was like, why you're not working for the same, why you don't aim the same way, you know. And on a way we have this dream of creating an ambulante that travels like those that are trying to survive travel, you know, mm-hmm. through all the way from Central America to Canada. So hopefully one day.
That's great.
Thank you for your question. It was
hi, Mr. Diego Luna. My name is Isamar, and this is my friend Daisy. And
that's an interesting
we came
way
up
to
with
start.
The question together. That's why.
All right.
Okay. As recent Chicana College graduates, what advice can you give us for creating social change in our local communities?
The first thing I could say is never lose the curiosity to know what's happening around you and to those that are not in front of you, but that you're part of, you know? I get a lot of time I get people that say, oh, I want to do something, or I want to do film. And you ask them, well, how many scripts you've write? Oh, no, I haven't, but I so desperately want to do it. I think you can do a lot because the main change needs to happen inside, you know, and then things start to happen naturally. If you truly believe in something, then that thing kind of becomes real, you know, and I think it's about being informed about if you do cinema, you have to be first part of the audience, you know, and never stop being part of the audience. And that way you allow cinema to exist, and then you can be part of something. And to me, filmmaking, again, is at least that's the way I see it, is you have to give so much. You miss so much. It takes so long that either you really care about it or you shouldn't be doing it, you know. And a film can change you as part of the audience. I believe films have changed me or marked my life. You know, I can think about where I was by thinking of what movie I was watching. To me, is that important? But then, I don't know what's important to you, if it's film, if it's writing, if it's whatever it is. If it's been a parent, you know, that's the biggest thing you can do. I mean, you can actually change and design the reality of someone. That's amazing. That's a big thing. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, over here. Okay, hi, I'm Michelle. I'm actually Filipino-American, and I see a lot of parallels with our experiences. I was wondering, in Caesar, in your movie, did you cover the multi-ethnic alliance between...
Definitely. Larry Ilyung is an important character of our film. And definitely, I mean, the whole decision on going on strike was made by the Filipino workers and then joined by the Mexicans or Mexican Americans. So definitely, it's there and it's part of history. And I think you'll be proud when you watch.
Good evening. I've seen your films and I love that film Cometa that you were in about 20 years ago. It's a beautiful film. I happen to have known Cesar Chavez, and I was at his funeral, and I remember at the funeral with the 50,000 people there, there were a film crew that was actually recording the funeral. I was wondering if somehow you had access to that film. And then the question I have basically is more in terms of the Chicano music. How are you dealing with the Chicano music? Because that was a big part of the movement.
Yeah.
The Chicano movement, the Teatro Campesino, that whole teatro with Luis Valdez that basically created an education for the farm workers, basically.
Definitely. That's one of the things that I love the most in the whole research. And Teatro Campesino is very famous in Mexico. I love the idea of using theater as a tool of understanding, you know. Many times you're confronted by so many things that you end up blocking yourself, but through humor also, they found the way to reflect and be critic and kind of, change the way people were seeing an issue, you know, and I thought it was amazing, and it's part of the film. The thing about the music, and that's also part of the complexity I hope I can bring to the film, is that if you go through the music that Cesar Chavez was listening to, you also find more jazz than anything else, for example. It was amazing. So you have the music of the movement, and it's there, and how important it was, you know, for the march they did to Sacramento, you know, they were accompanied by a band for the whole time. Music is always there, obviously, the colores. But also at the same time, there's a very kind of thing that today is related to sophisticated people that I would hate to call it sophisticated, but definitely very complex. Can you imagine him going into his office and putting Charlie or Miles Davis? He had My Funny Valentine there as one of his favorites, you know? So I want the film to have that complexity. So I believe today there's the easiest thing to do is put a tag on things, you know? So, there's going to be a mariachi in the film. But mariachi is not everything. In fact, when the mariachi comes, it's great for 5 minutes, but then you want to get rid of it because it's so loud. And I hope I find a way to show real people and that diversity also that the movement had and that the movement allowed to itself to have, you know. Otherwise, it would have never existed, you know, because differences were pretty clear, like language or something like that. So, it's going to be there.
I have a question about something you said earlier about why it is the case that documentaries are easier to make today because it costs a lot of money to finance a feature film and so on. Wouldn't you also argue that the real reasons documentaries are being made is because there's a crisis of journalism in not just here, but in many parts of the world? If journalists were really doing their job, we wouldn't need WikiLeaks, we wouldn't need all these documentaries, we wouldn't need all the leaks and the all the kind of stuff that moves through the internet, we find out. So my question to you is that, and I don't know how familiar you are with the crisis debate around Zero Dark Thirty, Catherine Bigelow's film, where she claimed first that it was a documentary, it was exactly how it happened, but now she's claiming that it's really a feature film and so on and so forth. So when you take a historical figure like Cesar Chavez or Malcolm X or what have you, and realizing that most Americans learn history through cinema, like it or not, I teach history, and most of my students, when I ask them why are they bored with history, they say it's just boring. And when they do engage with history is through television or through movies. So my question very quickly to you is that I'm anxious using the term the responsibility of the artist because that's a code word for censorship. But when you make a movie about a historical figure, realizing the world in which we live, how do you position yourself? What are the questions you ask yourself about not just this particular movie, but about using actual documents and to fictionalize them? What is that space between actual history and fictionalizing it?
I guess that I'm gonna divide into the answer, because the first thing is I don't necessarily agree with you that that documentaries have grown because of the absence of a strong journalist movement or not movement but a whatever situation action realidad. I think You can't ask a documentary to be objective, you know. There's always a point of view behind, and there's always a very personal and intense necessity. Otherwise, it's called, I don't know how you say, reportaje in English.
Reporting.
Which is different. When you go and see a documentary, there's a lot even the style takes you somewhere else, you know. And to me, I don't think cinema should carry the responsibility of informing. I think it can start a debate, it can raise a question, but then it's up to you to go there and go deep, you know. No one in 2 hours can explain anything, basically. There is no way you can understand completely and profoundly an issue in 2 hours. There's no way. And if you don't have that necessity afterwards, that talks poorly about you as part of the audience, you know? So my point, when I talk about the responsibility, I think the biggest responsibility is in the audience. And I believe I'm part of that audience before I'm a filmmaker. It's about when you buy a ticket, you allow that to happen. When you talk about a film, when you recommend a film to someone, you make that thing exist, and you give it you're giving it the weight that you're talking about. But I don't think film can come and become something else. It shouldn't, you know, because also film is an escape for the audience for many things. I kind of stop thinking about what's happening here, and I put my attention into someone else's voice. Then I go back and I start a conversation with that voice, if it mattered to me, and if not, I'll forget, and that's it. But I think that today you can read a lot, you can find a lot of. I don't feel that lack that you were talking about. I think we are in a very, very interesting time where you can actually decide who feeds you with information, you know. It's in countries like this is more people than in countries like Mexico, where probably not more than 20% of the people have access to internet. But it's getting there, and you can be the own editor of whatever you read. You know, you can choose who you read, and I think it's much better than when I was 15 years old. At least there was just two ways. There was a thing called Excelsior and another called Ovaciones. And that was it. That was your access to information, you know? And today, no one buys newspapers in Mexico. And it's very sad, but also because newspapers haven't grown into something else. But if you get connected in the web, you can read amazing things. I have to say I disagree.
We have time for just one more question, I think.
Damn,
one or
you
two.
Have the last one.
La wow. Última pregunta.
It's very good.
Gracias, Diego, por visitarnos aquí en la biblioteca. My question to you is, first, thank you for the work that you do through your production company in bringing important stories to the public. And that leads to my question. Have you encountered any difficulties or challenges in Hollywood in terms of bringing these stories to a broader audience? And the context for that is Argo is the example that I'm thinking about of whether you think the story of the Mexican American should have been portrayed by a Latino, or what your take on that that case was.
I'm not going to talk about that case. I think you already said enough. But I can tell you, our film wasn't financed in this country. When we tried to finance the film here, we didn't find enough interest in our film. When we went to studios, they asked us who was going to play Cesar Chavez. And obviously, I'm not going to say names, but we said it needed to be a Mexican American. You know, we couldn't change that. they got disappointed, and they said, "No, go do the film, and then if we like it, we'll buy it. But go do it yourself." And I understood many reasons why the film have never been made here, you know. Mm-hmm. But the amazing thing today is that you can do the story of Cesar Chavez with money from Mexico, and then other people join at the end. And today we have, for example, behind the film, an amazing company called Participant Media. Mm-hmm. They do amazing films, and they care a lot about the issue, and they want to get it out. But probably if we would have to wait for the 100% of the money to get it here, we'll be talking about a script that one day will be made, you know. So we decided we were going to shoot under certain kind of conditions that allow us to make the film, you know. And today we're very proud of that, and struggling again. On we learned to do film in Mexico, where paradoxically there is an amazing freedom over there to go and do something, you know. For a few, that's what's terrible, you know. For just a few, but those few can do anything. We build a company in 7 years. We've done more than 15 films. We have a film festival. It's complete freedom for us, you know. The thing is, the balance in our country is terrible, and the reality for a few is amazing, and then others have no opportunities. But I believe for film today, there's no way to think about nationality. You know, there is no, it's not countries doing films, it's people doing film. And that's very, I mean, that gives me a lot of hope, you know, because I was shooting a film about a Mexican with money from France, and someone over there cared about what's happening here, and that's unbelievable. That gives me hope, and I believe I'm going to be able to do this for a long time, you know, because no one today is going to set the rules, you know. Today, getting your film to be watched is in your hands, you know. I truly believe this. I hope I don't come here next year crying and saying I was an idiot by saying this. But so I don't know if that had anything to do with the question you made. But this is a good plan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you,
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.